And good day, everybody out there, and welcome to another edition of The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. I'm Dr. Z, Dr. Eugene Zampro, naturopathic wellness program on health and alternative medicine today. Thank you for joining us, and you can always get more information on our websites, which is naturalnurse.com and drznaturally.com. Kind of rhymes there. Well, today we have a fabulous show. I can't wait to start discussing with my long-term friend and actual co-host of a radio program that we did for many years. We have Master Ameni Harris on our show today. And the topic's going to be mantra marma therapy, healing the marma energy vortexes with prescribed mantric words of power, and seven dragons yogang, a system of mind-body-spirit energy exercises. A little bit about Ameni Harris. He began his career as a research scientist in the chemical engineering and paper, waste water treatment, mining, and enhanced oil recovery, and he earned four patents. But he was a lifelong student of yoga and yogic sciences for 45 years, and he studied with Sri Swami Satchidananda of Integral Yoga over a 15-year period, and became a senior yoga and medical Qigong instructor. And he's always been interested in the healing power of food, and so he studied at the Natural Gourmet Institute and obtained certification in Chef Corps Mastery, and he earned his MS in Nutrition at the University of Bridgeport, working as a clinical nutrition and food therapist, specializing in enzyme nutrition, naturopathic nutrition, and even African world food therapy, and he taught as an adjunct professor of nutrition at the College of Naturopathic Medicine, teaching holistic nutrition to the third-year naturopathic students. He's a herbalist and herbal product formulator, specializing in Ayurvedic Chinese medicine and ancient Egyptian medicine. He's worked at many medical centers, including my center, the Naturopathic Medical Center, Integrative Wellness and Life Prescriptions. He also has really helped me quite a bit in traveling to Chinatown, co-leading our education tours with the Natural Nurse. You know, we take people to Chinatown once or twice a year to learn about Chinese medicine. And again, being an international lecturer in holistic health, he was radio host for 20 years on WPKN Bridgeport, working with myself and other programmers on the program Black Introspectives and Integrative Wellness. Recently, he earned a doctorate in Ayurveda at the Ayurvedic Institute under Dr. Vasant Ladd from 2005 to 2013, writing his dissertation on the healing power of Khichdi and set up clinics in Antigua, West Indies, and in Bridgeport, Connecticut, helping to train medical doctors in Ayurveda. And his main focus now is as a writer and teacher in the ways and science of Ayurveda, and he's the author of the soon-to-be-released books, which is the subject of our show today, Mantra Marma Therapy and Seven Dragons Yogang. Also, he's writing The Five Elements Seasonal Herbal Healing System. Ameni, welcome to the program.
So I was there thinking for a moment, it sounds like you're talking about someone else, but in fact, I'm happy to be on with you this morning. How are you doing today, Doctor?
I'm doing great, and thank you so much for taking time to educate the listeners about yoga, Qigong, and the power of the mind and healing and tap into the source, you know. So let's start the program with actually defining yoga and Qigong, because that's kind of an integral part of what you're trying to share today.
Is Ellen with you? I wanted to say good morning to her, too.
Oh, yeah.
She's with you?
No, Ellen? Ellen's has the day off, but she's listening.
Oh, okay. All right. Sorry. I thought she was with you since you announced her. So your question again, please?
I wanted to you would talk about yoga. Okay. And the yoga sutras and tapping into the source and why and how that influenced you, and then how you took also Qigong and combined the two into this amazing system called Yogang.
Yeah. So maybe I'll start a little bit about my background. as to how I got into yoga. As a teenager, I'm like 6'3" and 230 pounds or so. And it just so happened that as a teenager, I had a big growth spurt one summer, and I was much taller than my, you know, classmates, and they used to tease me a lot about being bigger and taller and so forth. So I had a self-esteem kind of issue around being bigger than them and so forth. So it used to bother me. So as a way of escaping that kind of taunting being picked on, I spent a lot of time in the public library. And one day while I was there reading books, that I'd read a book per week or so, I found a book on yoga. And it had all this yogi from India doing all these seemingly impossible postures with his body, twisting and, you know, inverting his body and twisting and bending and so forth. So it intrigued me, and also it came to my consciousness that I somehow knew how to do this practice from some previous time. And so I started borrowing the book. One of the introductory chapters spoke about the nervous system and the endocrine system, the hormonal system, and how those get very much strengthened by doing the practice. And then one gains self-confidence, peace of mind, and so on. So I started practicing it, and it changed my personality. So I stopped being an introvert and sort of shy from people, and spending more time with books than with people, and began to even trying to teach my colleagues and friends yoga. You know, I was about 13 years old. I was early 1970s, and I found that as I practiced on a daily basis, I became stronger, more self-confidence, clear in mind about my gifts and talents, and also I developed a strong self-discipline to practice every day. And not only that, it gave me the discipline to do any other activities I was doing. I became grounded and and developed mastery of those areas that I was focused on. So it helped me with my studies, helped me with being more sociable, helping with, you know, finding my path and following it. So I advocate this for anyone who wants to get a clear understanding of why they came in terms of this lifetime, building internal confidence, clarity of mind, mental focus, concentration, and the ability to become self-mastered is the practice of yoga. So that's basically how I got involved with yoga. Upon graduating from high school, I came to the United States to continue my college studies. And I, just because I got so much benefit from the yoga daily practice, I continued doing it. And upon graduating from college, I moved from Florida to Connecticut, and was still with my practice. I found a teacher who I studied with for a few months, and he said, you know, you're quite some mastery of the yoga, at least the physical yoga practice, the asanas. And he said, you know, why don't you become a teacher? So I decided I asked him, well, what is the commitment? He said, well, you have to go to this ashram, this monastery, and live with these monks and study for, like, you know, 4 weeks. And I said, well, I just got married. I have only a short amount of vacation. I don't see how it's possible to go away for a whole month. Anyway, over time, it came to pass that I went to the ashram, the monastery in Virginia. And long story short, the book that I found as a teenager in Antigua, in the Caribbean, is the same teacher who was the head of that ashram that became my teacher as I studied there. So there's no coincidence, is the point I'm making, is that sometimes things come to us because it's in our destiny to follow a particular path. And so I studied the 7 levels of teacher training that they had there, the beginner level, intermediate teacher training, advanced teacher training, and then all the auxiliary teacher training. Like, for instance, we're going to get into, the Yoga Sutras and the teachings of Patanjali, which is the mastery of the mind through yogic science. And that was one teacher training. And then, you know, medical kind of qigong practices, like for cardiac patients and for stress management and other yogic teacher training programs I took there while studying over a 15-year period.
How does yoga still the thoughts of your mind? Because a lot of people think yoga is just, like I said, the physical asanas, you call them. But really, the goal is to control the thoughts and have union with the divine. Is that true?
Yeah. And if you go to the what they call the philosophy and science of yoga, and which is called the Patanjali Yoga Sutra, this is a great sage master who wrote what I call sutras or threads that bind together the science of yoga. In the second sutra, in the portion on contemplation, he talks about, he says, the quote is, yoga chitta vritti nirodha, and it means, in English, it means the restraint of the modification of the mind self is yoga. So let's break that down, unpack that a little bit. The restraint, meaning the control or regulation of the mind stuff or the thought waves, all right, is yoga. So it's not just the asanas. In fact, the asanas are just in preparation for gaining control of the thoughts. You know, thoughts are more very amorphic, very elusive. Your mind goes quickly from something in the past to something in the future to what's going on presently, and sometimes repeating the same thing over and over like a stock record and so on. The mind can be very easily disturbed. And this is why they have done so much studies on how to regulate and control people's mind, to buying habits, to advertisements and marketing and so forth, to study people so that they know that you program a person's mind by repetition, by jingles, by imagery, that then once the person sees the thing that they want you to buy or to grasp a hold of, or a path to take, or a pattern to follow, that you can be programmed. All right. So yoga is like the opposite of that. If you realize that the mind, the body, and your spirit are all connected, and one of the best ways to gain control over the thought waves of the mind, the first thing is to regulate how the body's function, so the body is grounded, is stable, is not full of toxins and stiffness and aches. So it's not your body, your mind is not being disturbed by your own body, because often when we're sick, when we're stiff and achy and so on, the mind then is caught up with worrying and being tense around the physical aspects of the body. So the asanas, as Patanjali described, more very, very precise in his teachings, is that there are two sutras that talk about the asanas and the physical body. One is that it says sthir sukham. When one attains a steady posture, one can then begin to gain control of the thought waves of the mind. So the first practice is to stretch and move and twist and bend and stretch forward and so on, invert the body to remove all the toxins and stiffness. Why the asana practice or the physical postures is to remove all the things that encumber and or make toxins or stiffness in the body, so that then you're not able to be at peace, right? So when you do the practice, the physical asanas, you're meant to sweat and detox and cleanse and rejuvenate the body, so that the body becomes light and it's not a burden on you or distraction from the mind. So you get the body, a physical body, out of the way per se. So when you sit, you can begin to experience a quietening of the mind. In yoga, there's a whole concept of koshas. Koshas mean sheets, all right? And most people think that they're only this physical body, but you're much more than just the body is just a housing, and what connects your mind to your body is your breath. So in yoga, it's called prana, the pranic body or the breath body. In Chinese, traditional Chinese medicine and Qigong, it's called the qi or energy body, all right? And so with the breath, if you are able, the next level on the yogic eight limbs, you have the two first limbs on the yogic system or Patanjali's Yoga Sutras is the yama and the yama, the practices that one would adhere to, or philosophical practices that one would adhere to give you a sense of not only moral teaching, but inner grounding, so that person is righteous, upright, disciplined, doing good, being good, loving, serving, and so forth, not only always getting and taking. So you have things like non-stealing, truthfulness. These are some of the practices of yama, niyama, contentment, purification. These are philosophical practices, but actually active things that one would do in your daily life to bring about a better person in terms of how they're thinking and functioning. But after that, the third rung is asana, and I mentioned that before, to get rid of the toxins in the body, the stiffness in the body, the illness in the body, the weakness in the body, calm the nervous system down, make one more grounded, so one could sit for hour, two or three, a whole day if you need to gain control of the thought waves of the mind without the body saying, you need to move, I need to stretch, I need to get up, I need to move around, and so on. Because once the body moves, the mind moves. You see, the mind is more subtle than the body, but they're connected to the breath. And so once you start moving the physical body, you begin to move, your mind begins to move. So once you're sitting, then you start doing what I call pranayama or breath practices to control the thoughts, because, like I said, the mind is connected to the body, the physical kosha, the physical body, and then you have the breath body or the pranic body, which is what you regulate with yogic breathing practices, and then you start gaining control of the mental body, the koshas that I'm saying, the sheets that are being regulated, the manamaya kosha, the pranamaya kosha, and so forth, the vignoyamaya kosha, which is the emotional body, which is even more subtle than the physical body. So once the mental body. So once you begin to gain control of your thoughts, being watching your thoughts, and you're like, you're chaining a little puppy, the mind gonna usually run off and think about, oh, I went to, what did I have on this date last night? Oh, we went out to dinner, I bought some flowers, she was very pretty in her dress, and we went, we had a beautiful meal, and so forth and so on. And the mind goes off, and the next thing you know, you're in some on the park bench with your sweetheart, all right? Not in the present moment, because the mind's like that. But you don't beat up your mind and get up disturbed by, well, the mind is running off. Like you train a little puppy, you say, come back and sit. Mm-hmm. And you keep the mind focused on the breath going in and out. The breath actually makes a particular sound. So the sound of the breath, the in-breath sound is so, and the out-breath sound is hum. So when you breathe in, you mentally repeat the sound so, and you breathe out, mentally repeat the sound hum. Obviously, you're using this as a mind control technique. You're controlling your own thoughts to be in the present moment by focusing on your breath and the sound of the breath. Another technique that Patanjali prescribes for people who have a very disturbed mindset in terms of emotional patterns and so forth, is to use a concept called Pratipakshavavana. What that means is that when the mind is disturbed by some negative thought or feeling, then one should then reflect on the direct opposite positive thought. So then if you're filled with rage or hate about something someone did, about some situation, you might think about love and seeing yourself being loving and caring and so forth. It is not that you're tricking the mind. It's like you're using the tools to keep the mind in a positive frame of mind. You know, the mind oscillates between the negative pole and the positive pole. And if you can program the mind to be in the positive pole, you can allow the emotion and passions and disturbances that normally come to the regular normal human mind to swing below you and not be disturbed, and you're not going to be swinging over to the negative but staying in the positive by programming the mind with this positive thought, which is the opposite of the negative that would disturb the peace. At some point, one begins to be able to sit still and be in the present moment, and that being in the present moment helps you are helped to be able to focus on the mind on one thing at a time. Meaning, your concentrating the mind. This is beyond the breath. Now you're focusing on one thing: a flower, a mantra. Some positive thing to keep your mind to transcend your thoughts and to focus on that one thing. This is mental concentration. All right, you're not in the meditation status yet. And then over time, one lets go of that object of focus and attain a stillness that the mind is no longer needing an object outside to focus on, but you experience the quietening of the thought waves of the mind, which is the beginning stage of meditation. And one sits for meditation and goes to the place where they experience the quietening of the mind, the not drifting of the mind, the inner peace that comes with that, to get a restoration, re-energizing of your person, a clarity, and even beginning to get glimpses of into right intuition, right insights as to problems that you may have, situations you're trying to solve, answers to particular situations that is beyond the thought of the mind, because the mind is now in a quiet place, and you're not thinking thoughts as to using your reasoning or your logic or your analysis or holistic thinking, because as quiet as it's kept with human thinking, with all those methods, logical thinking, reasoning, analysis, which is just breaking things apart to find the key substantive information or knowledge, and even holistic thinking, seeing the whole picture and so forth, can only give you 50% probability of being right. When the mind shifts away from thinking, or you tap into the all mind, the source of all things that makes you never make a mistake that the heart is not going to be in your lower abdomen, or the you're not going to be seeing the sun rising in the west and so forth, that it's always accurate, that spring never comes before winter and so on. All these things that we take for granted are governed by this all-mind God, the creator, this all-knowing source. So when you tap into meditation, you begin to tap into that knowing source, and then you get the right insights for inventions, for creativity and so on, beyond the mind. I'll give you an example of that. I worked as a research chemist in a company called American Cyanamide for many years in Stanford, Connecticut, and we were working on a project to develop some additives to paper products. You know, most people use products that in their daily life, but don't have a knowledge of how things are made. For instance, there are paper chemicals that are added to the paper-making process to give wet strength or dry strength. So one could put, say, 50 pounds of groceries in a bag and the paper, and it don't tear or fall apart because they're dry strength chemicals that make the paper bag stronger than it normally would with its tensile strength. Right? Then there are wet strength chemicals that added to paper to give absorbability of water without falling apart. So a paper towel might have in wet strength chemicals that when you wet it, it absorbs water, something spills, and it doesn't fall apart because they're wet strength agents that hold the fibers of the paper together. So it's still absorbent, but still remains in a whole sheet or so, all right? The same thing with a paper. See, you have a $100 bill and you forgot it in your pocket, and in the wash, you don't want the paper to fall apart. That's a valuable thing. So the wet strength chemicals to hold that paper together, because paper and water would begin to dissociate and make the paper fall apart. Well, this was a paper chemical application to put into paper products that have contact with food, like paper cups. You know, we drink coffee from Starbucks, right. So and you don't get the paper don't get wet. Well, the chemicals in it that repel the paper, the water from the surface of the paper, and also keep its integrity with wet strength chemicals in it, and even paper plates and other things like that. So the point I'm making is that the FDA clearance for the cationic, the positively charged chemicals, the polymers that we were synthesizing in the lab, were only allowed 10 mole percent, meaning 10% of the polymer composition would be acceptable without having any negative health repercussions for people from the paper interacting with the liquid or the food and so on. However, in our tests in the lab, only the 20 mole percent or 30 mole percent gave the performance that the manufacturer needed to make it economically feasible to buy the product. So after spending maybe a good 7 years and maybe five or six team members, PhD types and research engineers and so forth, and building manufacturing plants, so hundreds of millions of dollars invested, we couldn't get it cleared by the FDA. And the company even hired lawyers and a team of scientists to go and try to get through the Congress to appeal to the FDA to lower the standards. Right? Mm-hmm. But the byproduct of higher mole percentage, 20-30 mole percent in the paper product, could mean that it could be cause carcinogenic release toxins into the food or into the food from the paper product. So after not having finding an avenue to solve this problem, they were going to cancel the whole project. So I, being a team member from the beginning and one of the key persons in developing that whole product, and spent many years going around the country trying to install that technology in many paper mills around the country, I felt a deep connection to it. So in discussion once when I was at the ashram and around the same time of the dilemma with this product, I talked with one of the monks, and he said to me, look, if you want to get knowledge beyond how to solve that problem, why don't you take a crystal bowl of purified water and put it out in the full moon, now that you're here, it's in the full moon season, and it'll be energized, and then take that and put it beside your head and go with a clear intention of trying to understand the solution to fixing that problem. So I did that, and he said, keep a little notepad beside your desk or your nightstand, and when you wake up, whatever thoughts come to you, write it down as to it might be the answer to your solution. So I did that, and, you know, in a meditative state, go to sleep with focusing only on the idea of finding a solution to the problem and with this energized water from the full moon. And then it came to me that the next day that there's an additive that's added to the water, aluminum sulfate, that's added to the thick stock, meaning where the paper is grounded up and bleached as a thick stock before it's thinned out to make paper sheets. And they add alum to, when they grind the paper, there's like knots in the wood, you know, like knots you see in your wooden floor when you cut lumber. Well, those knots have a lot of pigments, and they are hard knots, and you grind it. When they're ground up with the paper pulp, they become like holes in the paper, and it's not a good thing. But the paper manufacturers have found that when you add aluminum sulfate to the thick stock, it coagulates those knots and have them become more dense than the thick stock and settles down to the bottom. You can drain it off or separate those pigments that would then make damage to the paper. A long story short, I'm saying is that the answer I got was to take an aliquot, a small percentage of that aluminum sulfate, and dilute it to the concentration of the additional, say, aluminum, dissociate into air to aluminum sulfate. The aluminum has a +3 charge, which will give additional cationic charge. And so I added the aluminum sulfate into the thin stock we were making the paper with the 10 mole percent cationic polymer, which is acceptable, and got the results of a 20 or 30 mole percent performance without changing, without needing to add the more carcinogenic or toxic polymers that gave the performance that we needed. So I got the performance of the 20-30 mole percent, which was acceptable for the manufacturer, without adding any more toxicity, and is without adding any extra cost, because it was added in the same aluminum sulfate was now being added not in the thick stock, but a small percent of it was added in the thin stock to make.
So basically, you use yoga to solve a human dilemma, which is amazing, by tapping into that whole superconscious mind. It's pretty amazing.
Yeah. So what we're saying is that this is not the only time, but you use it to be aware of fixing things, understanding things, knowing things that you would not normally know with a thinking, rational mind. And this is why the yogis are considered, when they become the high level of mastery, which is in the state of samadhi, meaning they're in meditation state all the time, they don't even need to sit for meditation anymore. After sitting for 20, 30, 40 years, your mind becomes so peaceful and so in the moment that one who sits for meditation may get glimpses of this peace or this quietness or this inner contemplative mind periodically when they sit for meditation. At the advanced stage, the higher stage, one then gets into the realm of being in a state of meditation. So you know without being told from outside the answers to anything, if it's in divine order and it's in your destiny to know, you can know.
Now moving into the Qigong, from yoga, because you developed this system of Yogong, combining the two, the monks also developed or had sacred sounds that they somehow figured out could help the organ systems, and the organ systems are connected to the emotions. Tell us a little bit about, jump into the traditional Chinese medicine from the yoga, tell us how you blended these two systems.
Okay, so Qigong, the meaning of it is that qi is a life force, what keeps us alive, you know. It's connected to the breath, and the cultivation of it, gong, is the cultivation. So qi is the life force, gong is the cultivation of it. So the practices that one would do to cultivate the life force so you have more of it or enough of it to stay well is what qigong is about. So in Chinese medicine, there are several branches. There's herbal medicine, there's acupuncture, there's tuina massage, and then there's Qigong. I like Qigong because anybody can practice it. And if you don't have acupuncture needles or you don't know where the acupuncture points are, if you know the right movements, Qigong movements, you can stimulate the liver channels and the energy to flow through it. You can stimulate the kidney channel and the energy to flow, kidney, bladder channel, and so forth and so on. So you're actually having a medicine that could be for the masses of the people by knowing what movements to do for a particular illness or a particular challenge that you have. You can then begin to cultivate the right movement of the life force, the qi, because the qi moves the blood, and blood is the life energy that sustains the organ systems. And so what Qigong is meant to do is to help you unblock the channels that come from stress from the environmental toxins, the air, water, food, from not getting enough rest, from negative thoughts or wrong thoughts, wrong thinking, overworking, overachieving, just a lifestyle that's out of balance, which is typical of Western living. So Qigong is meant to bring you into a more balanced, harmonious state, to open up the blockage in the channel to promote health and well-being. But at the highest level, it also includes things like meditation. And, you know, I've talked about in yoga, Ayurveda, the concept of kosha, the physical body, the physical kosha, then which is connected to the pranic or the chi kosha, the breath, and then the mental kosha. And then the emotional body, or vijnanamaya kosha, is one of the most subtle aspects. And then ultimately you have the spirit body. But because the emotional body is so close to the spirit body, it's easily affected, affect our health, and it translates into how we're thinking, the mental body. There's a hierarchy, the spirit body, and then the emotional body, then the mental body, and the chi or pranic body, and then the physical body. Well, often in the Western medicine, you might find a person having upset stomach or migraine headaches or whatever the issue, indigestion. And so the person may take some medication to deal with the physical symptoms, but it could be coming from the emotional body. For instance, if you're a worrier, all right, emotional worry, it disturbs the spleen stomach channel. And so the person might have digestive issues. They may have spleen blood form, red blood cell formation issues, blood cell carrying oxygen probably because the heme ion is not being formed properly in the red blood cell, or the B12 issues of utilization of food, the plasma that's in the blood that's being incorporated in the red blood cells to be assimilated around the body.
And sometimes hydrochloric acid and enzymes are shut down when we worry, you know.
Okay.
That's a fight-or-flight response, you know.
Yeah, and so the person also loses the sweetness for life.
Right.
And so that leads to problems with diabetic complications, pre-diabetic complications, because the spleen, stomach, pancreas is also interconnected in that whole digestion, absorption, assimilation process. So Qigong masters in meditation began to hear the healing sounds that would then purify or cleanse the specific organ system. So the sound that would help, for instance, get one transcend worry, not only to purify the toxic effects of having a worrying mind, but it also would take you to a state where you're purifying that emotion out of your mind, spirit, consciousness, so that you're not a worrier anymore. The sound is woo. So you're saying woo. And you could do a particular movement as stretching up with one hand facing up towards the ceiling, another palm facing down, and you're twisting, looking up as you're making the sound woo, and you're squeezing one side of the body while you're stretching up, the opposite side is being squeezed, and then you're changing sides. And as you stretch up, you inhale deeply and stretch up and make the woo healing sound. You're cleansing and purifying that emotional pattern of worrying. If you sit and just say the sound woo, it will take you into the trance meditation state where you can then begin to get an understanding of why you're worrying and how to not worry anymore just by saying the sound.
Mm.
Because
I know the sound for anger is shoo. Shoe, like
and,
tying your shoe, which is kind of an interesting word.
Which is
word.
One of the quickest, one of the most easy, quickest way to get disturbed is through the liver channel. And the liver gallbladder has to do with rage, frustration, tension, anger. And especially in Ayurveda, highly recommend that people don't suppress their emotions, meaning you're not going to just blurt out and punch somebody in the face because you get angry, but you're not going to suppress that emotion and cause yourself to have hypertension or eye problems or, you know, migraine headaches or heart attack or stroke because you're suppressing the emotion. But a healthy way to express the emotion would be to do the healing sound for the liver, the shoe healing sound. And even more potent sounds that they discovered, that even if you have illness to the, say, for instance, organ system like the liver, if you have liver qi stagnation that's not been treated for many years, meaning that the qi is stagnated, the life force is stagnated there, and the blood also is stagnated, it leads to things like blood tumors, like fibroids and so on.
Right.
And
right.
It also could lead to things like stenosis of the liver, cholesterol problems, because the liver actually is the source of cholesterol, and it also would mean things like even cancer of the liver. So there's sounds that helps to support the liver in regenerating itself and staying regaining its health. The sound is the guar healing sound, all right? And it would be the practice is different than just making the healing sound for the liver with the hand below around the navel and right hand down for men and left hand on top, and making the healing sound shoe with the focus on the palms. But in terms of the guar healing sound, the feet would be like a good 3 feet apart, and one would twist to the right and make the healing sound with a long sound. Whoa. And so one would twist from right to left and making that sound, and starting with a deep breath, making the sound as you exhale. When the breath ends, the sound ends, and you should be fully twisted to the left. And you do that 9 times, because 9 is the representation of the energy of the energy patterns of the spirit, 9 aspects of the spirit. And so then you would do that 9 times, and then you'd go from the left to right, but with a different, we'd go from left to right, inhaling deeply at the, in fully on the left side, and as you exhale, the same guar healing sound till you, the body's facing forward, and then you change to a higher octave, so you go from guar, and that sound helps to begin to remove stock toxins that are built up, to purify the liver, to regenerate liver cells, liver copper cells, and to help the liver in its own cleansing and regeneration. Because often, see, the liver is connected to the circulation of the blood, is second only to the heart. And because the liver takes the blood, and it has to be purified by the liver to before it's recirculated throughout the body. Right. And often, because there's so much environmental toxins, you know, toxins in the water, or pesticide, plastics, just pretty poisons put on our skin, you know, deodorant.
Like, you always used to say that.
Dyes, you know, cosmetics and so on. We are, you know, going into the liver, and then the liver, if we don't do anything to clean the liver, especially during the springtime with green foods and green drinks and green, you know, herbal things that are very known to help the liver, over time, many years, the liver began to get sick. On top of that, people drink a lot of alcohol, and then in combination with that, a lot of frustration and rage and tension and anger and even hatred and so forth build up, you know, a ticking time bomb for the liver. So that guar healing sound would help to, as a daily practice, one
almost like
to
it's almost like milk thistle, kind of like, because, you know, it's interesting, herbs. I want to get more into, in the last 10 minutes of the show, I want to talk a little about herbs and food. So basically, everything's vibration, at you're basically saying, you know, whether it's the mantras from yogic or the sacred sounds developed by the monks, like the shu that we talked about, or the gua, a lot of things have to do with vibration. And I guess that's kind of, whether it's sound or the vibration of an herb or the vibration of a homeopathic or the vibration of water in our body or the vibration of our thoughts, all that percolates down to the very essence of our body and gives us either health or disease. So what's your, tie this into kind of Ayurveda and your other work with cooking and diet and things like that as we come to the last 10 minutes of the show.
Yeah, yeah. Well, one would have to understand that your physical body is a food body, all right? And so what we eat becomes our body. So different people, everyone has a different type, meaning mind-body type. And when we are stressed, and stress comes in many forms, not sleeping, not getting enough sunlight, disobeying the laws of health, meaning there's a law of health that says you should eat healthy, natural, nutritious, tasty food that then you are eating with some percentage of it live, so it's full of enzymes that are going to digest. Or if you're not taking the food, if the food is cooked, because not everything can be eaten raw, you need to take enzymes or have food enzymes that are pre-digested food, like prebiotic type food like kitchery and so on, to help help the gut and its your body's ability to secrete the right enzymes for itself, from the liver enzymes to the stomach acids and the protease and so on, pepsinogen and so on in the stomach, to the salivary gland that secretes carbohydrates, amylase and so on, lipase, to help with the digestion. And then the small intestine, the pancreas also, to help with secretion of enzymes to help you digest and absorb the food into the bloodstream, so that you can then make proper assimilation in the spleen with the B12 and iron to take up oxygen, and B12 to help with the absorption and assimilation of food. So in a nutshell, I'm saying that there are laws that we should obey, and most of us don't, you know, obey. The assimilation and digestion of food is one important law that we should obey. We should
so basically, food should feed our cells. Food. We just shouldn't just eat to live to eat. We should eat to live and feed our cells, because that feeds the mind and feeds our spirit. This is basically what you're basically saying.
Yeah, the food, the higher the energy in the food, you call it vibration, it feeds not only the physical body, but it also feeds the subtler body, meaning your mind and your thought and ability to concentrate and ability to learn and ability to create and have right intuition and insight come from the subtlization or the higher energy, you know, the energized food now begin to feed your mind. If you eat, just like if you eat a big steak or something, very heavy, very dense, and you might find that you want to fall asleep. All right? Mm-hmm. But if you eat a nice salad or some fruits or something, you might want to go run a marathon because it has much more energy, it's alive, and it's stimulating the energy in the body. In Ayurveda, we consider, well, there are three, it come to the West as three major main body types. And it's the energy of the taste of the food that is identified with the body type. So if you're Vata type, which is the energy of the wind and the ether, wind moving through the space in the sky, is for it tends to be drying and stimulating. So that Vata energy, a person tends to be, if you look at the person's body, if you're going to try and see, well, if this is a Vata type person, then what is the diet for them? The Vata type person needs to be skinny, slender, wiry, quick movement, quick talking, easily excitable, nervous, anxious type, very creative, very artistic, a spontaneous kind of person, and they're the life of the office or the home and so forth, energy. But they tend to get ungrounded because they're up in the air all the time. They suffer from issues with coldness, so they need warm foods. They need more heavy grounded foods, so root vegetables, heavier grains like brown rice. They also need things like beans that are higher in density, like chickpeas and kidney beans and so on, that are more grounding, oils that are soothe the nervous system, calms down the particular person, so that ghee and olive oil, heavier oils, sesame oil that are warming, are better for Vata types. The taste that helps to calm the nervous system and the Vata personality would be they need the sour taste because it collects moisture. They need the salty taste because it also helps with moisturization and stimulation of the digestion and absorption and so forth. And it helps the kidneys, the hormonal system. The sour taste helps the liver and the stimulation of the liver. And it all they need the sweet taste because sweet turns into fat. So those would help to they tend to burn calories quickly, so by eating the sweet taste and that turns into fat, if excess sugar turns into fat, basic biochemistry in the body, they would help to be more stable and grounded and so forth. They need heavier vegetables, like I said, root vegetables, potatoes, sweet potatoes, carrots, things that grow under the ground or heavier in nature, rather than the light things like lettuce and, you know, things that in the air a lot is not so good for Vata. For Pitta types, which would be the type of medium-built person who tends to be affected by the emotion of anger and frustration easily. They are very super smart people. They tend to like to be in charge. They don't like to take orders. They make good directors and leaders and so forth. They don't like people to waste their time or their intelligence because they're very intelligent. They tend to be the leaders and so on. However, the sour taste and the spicy foods and the, you know, hot spicy foods and the salty taste aggravates Pitta. So instead, to calm Pitta down, you would need things like sweet taste, bitter to cleanse the blood, because they have blood issues, tendency to have blood skin issues and so forth. So you would eat if you wanted the spice taste, you would use things like cumin, coriander, fennel, cardamom, that are cooling. They have spice taste, but they don't have. It's not hot like cayenne or ginger, and so on. Garlic, all right. So this would be the type of things that pitta type would need. In terms of the kapha, which is the big-bodied person, the person just walks by the kitchen and smells the food and puts on the weight. they need dried foods, drying things like sun-dried tomatoes or apricots or dried apples, things that the moisture is dried out of them. They also need astringent foods, things that dry out moisture. A good astringent kind of food would be like you bite into, say, an apple, a green Granny Smith apple. It feels like you're a puckering or drying effect in the mouth. Well, that's the same kind of thing on a cell, same energy. You're talking about energy before. The vibration of that taste on that astringent taste would be experienced even on the cellular level, so that you dry the moist tendency to, for the cells to have water in them would begin to
And lose weight and balance weight,
by eating these. Then there's also bitter taste. The bitter taste is good for the heart, good for the cardiovascular system, but the bitter also slows down the appetite and helps the person not to crave so many starchy, sweet, heavy, oily, creamy, kapha types, it seems like they're attracted to the heavy, sweet, creamy foods because it nourishes them and helps them. Kapha has a tendency to have emotion of grief and guilt and even greed and attachment to loss. So these sweet, creamy foods tend to assuage those feelings. And so there's a great tendency for a person to be attracted, if they're kapha type, to be attracted to that, those foods, because it's in a way they're doing therapy, self-healing, by eating foods that help them to transcend or get beyond the emotions of being feeling grieved over loss or attachment. You know, like a person goes on an eating binge because they lose an opportunity or lose something of value. The person uses food, ice cream or some, every heavy, sweet, cold thing to help them transcend or deal with the issue, but then they put on 30, 40, 50 pounds by doing that. The opposite is true for kapha type. You need movement. We don't have stagnant pools of water. We need alkalinity. We need stimulation with rigorous movement. We need spicy, hot ginger, pippily, black pepper, chicatoo, things like that to stimulate the movement of the water out of the cells. We need foods that are high in potassium that kicks waste and water out of the cells. So, eggplant would be one. Green bananas. These are very, very astringent. Green bananas, green plantain, not the ripe ones so much, but these are very, very astringent, meaning they dry moisture out. So they'd be very good for kapha. Light grains like quinoa and millet and so on, because light is counteracting the heaviness of kapha, and it would then help the person to be more balanced and not be so attached to things that in the past or craving for things that they don't have as yet and create aggravation in their mind spirit. I was telling you that one of the things that we're working on in terms of helping people is to understand that in the body, we talk about mama points for a moment here. Like acupuncture, there are many, many specific points on the body. In the soles of the feet are major points, the kidney points, the liver points, the gallbladder, the stomach channels are in the feet in and so forth, the spleen, all right, in the big toe and across, and so on, the instep, the kidney points and so on around the ankles and so on. Well, I'm saying that to say, we have all these energy channels that are in the calf muscles and around the knees, the major joints, very sacred points, psychic points around the ankles, around the knees. The navel is a major point because it connects you to the mother and the prenatal chi that's passed on to you from what you inherited from your ancestors and so forth in the womb. Well, the same, you can anoint with special oils, kaffir oil, if you have a kaffir, too much ama or toxins in the stomach, and you have poor digestion, poor elimination, and so forth. To anoint the navel with kaffir oil, if you're ungrounded and nervous, anxious, can't sleep, scattered thinking, you might use vata oil. If you're, you know, hot-headed, aggressive, bossy type, you might use pitta oil to anoint the navel, and these are major mama points. Right? The another mama point that I want to mention is the xiphoid bone, the little tail hanging off of the sternum. If you press in the air where there's an indention, you can hold that with some of the particular oil for your body type. If you're pitta type, you use pitta oil and so forth, and hold it for 2 minutes and focus in your awareness there, and you will help with digestion in the upper stomach, remove acidity, burning, and so forth. And just holding that point, gastric upset and so on.
Unfortunately, we're running out of time. It's already 50-something after the hour, so we're going to have to
Thank you, but I was saying these are special points that one can use by knowing where and how, what to press, and holding it for 2 minutes, and focusing the mind, and you even saying sacred words or mantras that are specific to that point, one can facilitate their own healing. I guess in a nutshell, if I have to say one wrap-up thought, is that most of the work I'm doing is to bring the knowledge to the people about what is the natural healing science that they can use in their own lives at home, whether it be diet, whether it be Qigong or yoga or Yogong, or mama therapy. You don't really need to have a doctor or you need to have special medicine. Much of these things are things that we're doing every day. If you know the right exercises, the right breathing, the right points to press, or the right diet, one can stay well all the time.
Where can folks get in contact with you, Master Harris?
Well, you know, you can contact me at my phone. It's 203-864-5399. 203-864-5399. That's probably the best way. Or you can email me at eharris05@snet.net. That's eharris05@snet.net.
Looking forward to your books coming out, coming up soon. We're learning about Yogong and diet, and more about Ayurveda from your perspective. Thanks so much for joining us. We'll have to have you on to continue our discussions of these ancient sciences, because we just scratched the surface and there's so much more to discuss. But thank you so much for taking the time to really delve into and weave these things together into an integral system. Appreciate it. Many blessings.
All right, man. Thank you for allowing me to be on with you. And hopefully maybe we can get together. I can share some of these with you personally.
Yes, sounds great. Okay. And that does it for another edition of The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z, wishing you folks health and wellness. Bye-bye. Till next week.